It's time for everyone's favorite podcast on the web. Live it off the wall. Where you give the best sports talk and info in New York.
Let me tell you something you already know. The world ain't all sunshine and rainbows. It's a very mean and nasty place, and I don't care how tough you are, it will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody is gonna hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done. Now, if you know what you're worth, now go out and get what you're worth. But you gotta be willing to take the hits and not pointing fingers saying you ain't where you want to be because of him or her or anybody.
It's an all-new Off the Wall on YesNetwork.com. And here's your host, Chris Sheeran.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Off the Wall podcast here on YesNetwork.com. And we begin with a man who needs no introduction, but I'm going to give him an introduction anyway. And that is Hall of Famer, Dodgers manager from 1976 to 1996, the NL Manager of the Year in 1983 and 1988. If you haven't figured it out yet, of course, we're talking about the icon in Dodger history, Tommy Lasorda. Mr. Lasorda, welcome to the program. We appreciate the time today.
And I appreciate you calling me Tommy.
Not a problem. Tommy, the baseball universe pretty much revolved around the Dodgers and the Yankees in the late 70s and the early 80s. What was that like being in the middle of that as the manager of the Dodgers?
Well, you know, when you had those two teams in the World Series, you linked the whole nation. You know, when there were two New York teams in the World Series, the people from the Midwest on out weren't as interested as they would be if there were a team representing that area or those areas.
Right.
And I think that's the thing it was. It covered the whole country. And that's, I think, was very, very good for baseball and, of course, for the Dodgers, because in the 5 years, the first 5 years that I managed, I was in three World Series in those first 5 years, and two of them were against the Yankees.
Right.
So it was a very exciting World Series. A lot of things that kind of went wrong as far as decisions, but it was good.
Well, you lost in 77 and 78, but in 81, you actually beat the Yankees. So what was that feeling like in 1981 where you finally got over the top and you beat the Yankees?
Well, you know, I kept saying, you know, in my prayers, if you could see it in your heart, to make it be in another World Series where we would be with the Yankees. I needed them. I needed to play them very, very much. And then in 1981, my prayers were answered.
Indeed they were.
And we did. We did the opposite of what they did to us. They won the first two games, and then 81, and we turned around and won the next four.
Right. Now, that was exciting for you, no doubt. But in 1988, Kirk Gibson, that game against the A's, take us through that game when Gibson hit that home run basically on one leg. Was he even dressed when the game started?
No, he was never dressed until he came out and talked to me in the eighth inning. That's when he came out and told me he thinks he can hit. The thing about it was that Bob Costas had come out and said, this may be the worst team ever put on the field in World Series history. And that just fired our players up.
Yeah.
Really fired them up, because when they went out on the field after we had the meeting, and they started hollering at him across the field, screaming at him, and just the incentive they let build this club up and to believe in that this is what it has to be to beat those Oakland guys. After all, Oakland had a powerful team.
I never knew that Costas fired up your bunch like that. And the thing about that is, when Gibson hits the home run, Jack Buck says, I don't believe what I just saw. Did you believe what you just saw when he hit that home run?
Well, you know what? That's what you put him up there for, hoping that it would happen. And there was a little bit of strategy involved in the thing, you know, the things that you don't really know about, is the fact that I put up Dave Anderson when Mike Davis was hitting for the shortstop. I put Dave Anderson on the on-deck circle. Now, Mike Davis had played for Oakland the year before, and he hit about 24 home runs, 25. So old Eckersley, and rightly so, figures, I'm not going to let this guy hit the ball out of the ballpark because I can pitch to Anderson.
Uh-huh.
And when he did walk Davis, that's when I sent him out of the dugout. I did not want them to know that he was going to hit. So as soon as he walked out of the dugout, I mean, the fans, I'd never seen anything like it. I got goosebumps just watching the reaction of the fans when he walked out. Because the whole game they were saying, he's not going to be, he's not even in uniform. He's in the training room on the table.
He's basically using the bat as a cane to get to the plate, too.
It was like it was written for a movie.
It couldn't have been scripted any better. And to do what he did against pretty much the best closer of that time in Dennis Eckersley was just unbelievable.
Well, naturally. I mean, Eckersley even said it. He couldn't wait till the guy cut up there. He said he was looked like he was crippled. And he said, I'm going to make quick work of him and the game's over. But it changed. And when he hit that ball. But you look at this World Series. And if I would have, you were a betting man and I were a betting man. And before the series started, I would bet you that Earl Hershiser would have more hits than Canseco and McGuire combined. What would you say?
I would say you're out of your mind.
Yeah, but I'd have won.
Yeah, you absolutely would have.
He had three hits, and they each had one hit, of course, were home runs.
Uh-huh.
But it was only two times they were on the base.
Now, let me fast forward us to the Dodgers of the present day. How have Joe Torre and Don Mattingly affect? I mean, you are Mr. Dodger. So how has Torre done and how has Mattingly been out there? You know, two guys who are basically stamped Yankees now running the Dodgers.
Well, the only real true Yankee was, what's his name, the first baseman. He was a true Yankee, Joe.
Don Mattingly, Torrey's been all over. But with his success as the Yankee skipper, he's kind of indoctrinated into the Yankees as an all-time Yankee.
Well, I don't think that you could say he was an all-time Yankee. But the years that he was
I'm not going to argue with you, Mr. Lasorda, that's for sure.
Well, no, I'm not arguing, but I'm being factual.
Yes.
The years that he was there, he... he was a success and a great contribution to that team.
Right.
And when we got him here, I was happy that they brought Joe to be our manager because we needed somebody like him to put our club where it belongs. And in the first 2 years, naturally, he had us in the playoffs. And, of course, we just won one or two games short of being in the World Series.
Yeah, ran into the Phillies twice.
He's done an outstanding job for the Dodgers.
Right. Now, let me take it one step further. Now, a lot of young pitchers these days, and I'm asking you this because I want to get your opinion, being a manager, a former manager, and dealing with young starting pitchers over your career. A lot of these teams now, and it's basically because of Mark Pryor and Kerry Wood and how their arms just went south after, you know, using these guys and sometimes overusing them. Do you think young pitchers should be able to pitch the way they should, or do you think they should be put on the shelf? As you know, Phil Hughes is now getting skipped at his next start because he's, you know, they want to watch his innings. Do you think that's smart of teams to do, or do you think that's actually making the pitchers regress when they do that?
That's it, because I believe this, that these pitch count is one of the worst things that could happen to our game, especially to the pitchers, because in order to strengthen your arm, you have to throw.
Right.
And you have to throw a lot to get that arm in real great shape. And that's that. They're taking the kids to the minor leagues today on pitch counts. And then when they come to the major leagues, they can't go the distance because their arm has not been prepared to go nine innings.
Mr. Lasorda, I completely agree with you. This is Joe Auriemma of the Yes Network as well. I wanted to go back to that 77 and 78 World Series. The 77 World Series, you know, it's both involving Reggie Jackson. Reggie Jackson has a three-home run game. I just want to get your thoughts on that. And I also want to talk about the interference play in Game 4 in 78. Let's start with the three-home run game. Give me your thoughts on what was going through your team's head that night.
Well, I think it was both. Times I think that he hit the three home runs and got hit with the ball, wasn't it?
Yeah. He hit the three home runs in Game 6 of the 77 World Series to close that series out. And then the next year, there was a big argument in Game 4 because Reggie stood between the bases. And there was the soft liner, and that was just a bad play. Lou Piniella should have been called out, and it kind of turned the tide of that series as well. And
let's talk about 77.
Okay.
First, we won the first two games.
Yeah.
And lost the next four, but the thing about it was that there was a picture in the paper. Steve Garvey is called out, and the umpire's not even in the picture.
Yeah. Yeah. There were some really bad calls in the World Series, and actually.
Yeah. Well, they don't make mistakes. That's fine.
Yeah, that's true.
That's the thing that I thought that really hurt us was that one particular play. And that we lost that game, which we probably could have won if the runner counted, say.
Yeah. Right.
So that's the thing about it. But, and then the third baseman put on an exhibition that like I've never seen before.
Yeah, Greg Nettles really did. That was the shining moment of his career. He played such a great defensive third base both years in 77 and 78 for the Yankees.
We must have hit in the four double plays that he started.
It's true. It's very true. And, you know, Mr. Lasorda, looking at those three series between 77, 78, and 81 when you finally did break through, just the whole Yankees-Dodgers rivalry, going back even into the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, it's just such a storied history, and that's what makes this a weekend series so special, because there are a lot of, you know, New York fans that remember when the Dodgers were in Brooklyn and they finally broke through in 55 and beat the mighty Yankees and the Don Larsen perfect game. There's just so much history between these two teams. What can you say about these two storied franchises?
Well, I thought in 1977, 78, and 81,
mm-hmm.
that we had a better ball club than they had. I believe that. But the scene didn't work out right. But then in 81, well, practically the same two teams, and we beat them.
Yeah.
But I think, in my own heart, that we should have beaten them in the two series before that.
So you definitely feel that the Dodgers should have come out of that series 3-0, but really
Absolutely.
Just a couple of bad breaks.
If you look at the Nettles, we could have scored probably eight or nine runs.
And there's no doubt about that, Mr. Lasorda. I have one.
I mean, this guy put on a clinic.
He did. He
fielding.
And you know, one, he's a very underrated third baseman in the history of the game.
Well, not with me, he's not.
I actually have one more question for you. I'm a Jersey guy. I grew up in New Jersey, and I come from Italian-American heritage. And I know, like you, I am a big Frank Sinatra fan, and you knew Frank. I actually heard you on a radio program talking about a story between Ted Williams and Frank Sinatra. Just what are your thoughts about, the greatest singer of all time, Mr. Francis Albert Sinatra?
Well, it showed that the relationship and the affection that each people have, their titles and what they do, almost like what our game does. So when you get two of them together, it's a respect and admiration society. Because they each are tremendous people in their particular field. Now, when Ted Williams was at a dinner in Toronto, and I was the featured speaker, and they were honoring a young hockey player by the name of Wayne Gretzky, nobody even knew he was there. He hit Ferguson Jenkins. They were sitting in the audience. So I got up and I introduced them. And then he gave me a signal to call him after the dinner in the hotel. So I did, and I went up to his room, and we had a great, great talk about baseball and everything. Then he finally said, "Hey, you're a good friend of Frank Sinatra's, aren't you?" I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "Boy, Tommy, I never met the guy, but I think the world of him. I love his singing.
Wow.
He's one of the greatest." And I said, "Why don't you tell him yourself?" Now, this is 3 o'clock in the morning, Eastern time, and that's midnight at Palm Springs. But I know Frank doesn't go to sleep early, so I call him. And I hear, "Somebody wants to say hello to you." And Ted got on, as you know, his strong, "Hey, Frank, I was telling Tommy, and I think the world of you. You're great, blah, blah, blah." And then he finished and he handed me the phone. And Frank Sinatra said, "I can't believe it. I was talking to Ted Williams."
Oh, wow.
Now, you talk to Mutual Admiration Society. It was there.
Well, Mr. Lasorda, Joe and I can't begin to thank you enough, not only for coming on today, but what you've meant to this sport that we love so much as well. We really appreciate it.
Anytime. It's a great, great station. They bring a lot of sports to the fans. They get the opportunity to see things that they have never seen before and hear things they never heard before. So may you continue to do that.
Mr. Lasorda, thank you so much for those kind words. And also one more thing for me. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this, and that was growing up watching you as the Wizard on the Baseball Bunch. I got to tell you, this has been an absolute thrill for me. I really appreciate your time, and hopefully we could talk to you again in the future.
A lot of the people see me, they call me the Wizard, because when they were kids, they watched that show. I thought it was a great show.
It was tremendous.
Johnny Bench and I have talked about it before. Maybe we'd like to bring it back again.
Ah, that would be great, and I would love to be a part of it.
Okay.
All right, take care, Mr. Lasorda.
Okay, bye.
All right, bye-bye. That's Tommy Lasorda here on the Off the Wall podcast. We'll be back with Kevin Kernan right after this.
Go to YesNetwork.com for the best Yankee blogs on the web. It's The Blob with Bob Lorenz, Keeping Up with the Joneses with Kim Jones, River Ave Blues, and much, much more. For wall-to-wall Yankees, it's YesNetwork.com.
It's Off the Wall on YesNetwork.com. Here's more from Chris Sheeran.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Off the Wall podcast here on YesNetwork.com. Chris Sheeran, Joe Auriemma, and joining us now on the phone, the New York Post's Kevin Kernan. And, you know, Kevin, I didn't know until I read your article. The Mets share the same home record as the Yankees, 25-10. They are just hot at Citi Field.
Yeah, you know, that's gotten by a lot of people because it's so easy to dump on the Mets and the problems they've had this year. But, Chris, they've done a great job of turning that field into a home field advantage just like the Yankees have. And I can list all the things everybody knows about the size, but one of the things I want to point out is probably something people haven't picked up on and why it's successful for the Mets. Opposing outfielders come to Citi Field and they immediately freak out. The right fielder sees the brick wall on the side, the depth behind him. The center fielder sees all the space he has to cover. The left field sees the big wall, the kite wall, and the space he has to go to. So immediately what they do is they play too deep. And the Mets get a lot of hits in front of guys, and they're shooting the gaps well. So they've turned it into a tremendous. Once they get over the thing that they're not going to hit home runs, they've turned it into a really mentally strong park for them. And you got to have players who can make that adjustment. So I think that's one of the things that's going on there. And of course, we all know it helps the pitchers, and that's why they got the exact same record as the Yankees. When I saw that last night, I said I didn't even realize this. So I was looking at the stat sheet, and that's why I put it in the story. It's pretty amazing. And wouldn't it be something down the road, not that I'm saying it's going to happen, but wouldn't it be something if there were a Subway Series in October with both these teams and their home field advantages?
Absolutely. Well, you know it's going seven, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Well, you brought up starting pitching, so let's go there for a second. It's not all the time that you hear current players on a team saying to their management, hey, we need another top-notch starter. We want to go for this championship. We want to go for a pennant. But Johan and the other Mets, when they had the day off, back on Monday, they did say this. You know, they want to go out and get a Cliff Lee. They want to go out and get a Roy Oswalt. They want, you know, they're competing, but even Johan is conceding that, hey, we need someone else, even with me and Pelfrey and Nice the way he's coming along. What are your thoughts on that, and who do you think the Mets could, you know, realistically come across getting?
Well, Johan is an incredible competitor, and that's why he's that way. You know, he runs his own softball team in the off season down in Venezuela.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and he actually, I think he sneaks in a few at-bats down there, too, even though the Mets don't know, officials don't want to know it. But that's the kind of guy he is. He came sprinting through the clubhouse the other day when they were playing the Yankees, because the Mets have a pool with the World Cup, and his team, I think it was Italy, had just scored a goal. And he was like, you would think that he was, the prime minister of Italy or something like that.
Did he slide across the floor like they do have to
score? Practically, just about. He basically did that. And he was pitching that day. So that's the competitive nature of this team. And they all know they need a number one along those lines, a veteran number one, because Johan's fastball has gone downhill. You know, that's a little
right,
bit
and you wrote about that after the Yankees and Mets played that game on Sunday as well. It's actually, he said, one bad pitch, one very hittable fastball.
Exactly. So they know they need help. And about a month ago, I wrote that Oswalt is a guy they would love to have. Players were telling me that off the record at the time. And Oswalt has, through back channels, has checked in with the Mets and has told them he would go there. Of course, I caught a lot of flack because everybody was saying Oswalt wouldn't come to the Mets. But believe me, he would go there if he could. Obviously, Texas is a big team. I think Texas will make a big run at Oswalt. And Cliff Lee, I don't see the Mets getting Cliff Lee unless they really give up a Henry Mejia, and I don't see that happening. I have a sneaky suspicion that Cliff Lee, and this is just a guess on my part,
right,
but I have a sneaky suspicion that Cliff Lee will wind up with the Twins, and that could make things very interesting.
Oh, yes, it will.
So, the Mets need it. You know they need a number one. They would love to get Oswalt. I don't know if they can get him, but they're certainly going to be in the hunt, and they have enough young talent. And they're not afraid to trade for it because Jerry Manuel, I think we've seen that he's a guy that lives for today. He doesn't care about tomorrow. In many ways, he's like Joe Torre was. You know, if a guy's dressed, he's ready to play. If a guy's going to go out there, he's my guy. So
right.
It's not like I think the Yankees have a little bit different perspective now under Joe Girardi and keep things a little bit more balanced on, let's look for the future as well as the present. But I think Manuel and Omar are both looking at today. So I know they'll make a pretty good offer down the road.
Now, the Mets are set to get someone back that's kind of like a trade, and that's Carlos Beltran. And you called him a booster rocket, but he has to know his role when he comes back. So when he comes back with Pagan playing so well, how do the Mets handle this?
Yeah, it's going to be a difficult one, and I'll tell you why. Because the players, to a man, they love Pagan. Not that they don't like Beltran, but Beltran is a little bit more introspective. He's not a kind of guy. Once you get to meet him, he's a very nice, he's a wonderful guy, very nice man. But they see Pagan as more of a team player. And by that I mean, you know, he'll break up a double play. He'll do what he has to do. Beltran is a superstar who really, you know, and some superstars are just into themselves so much that they're not really trying to be negative towards the team, but they can be if their superstar ability is not working 100%. So what's going to happen here, I think, is they need to mix Beltran in slowly, and I think there's still a long way to go with this. I'm still not convinced that knee is where it needs to be for him to be a major league center fielder, especially at Citi Field. But they can't just say, hey, great job, Angel, take a seat. They need to really almost say, Beltran, we're moving you in 2-3 days a week and
right.
see how it goes, and then go from there and see if his knee holds up. Because you can't just take Francoeur out of this lineup. I know people are screaming, saying, well, just take Francoeur. That right field, as I pointed to earlier, is the most difficult right field and maybe difficult outfield position in all the majors to play, and Francoeur is brilliant at it. Plus, he has a strong arm. Plus, he's done a nice job with RBI,
yeah.
stolen bases. He's done a lot of little things to become a team player this year.
Do you think, Kevin, that the Mets would entertain the notion of maybe to entice one of these teams to – I know you said they might not be in the hunt for Cliff Lee, but if Pagan is added to that mix, do you think they would include him in a trade to bring one of these guys over?
I think they would if it came down to that. I definitely think they would. You know, you'd really be playing with fire there, but I think it would be one of those things you can balance off by saying we got this. And of course, someday Fernando Martinez may be up here. But I think they're going to look at all options because – I think, especially with Oswalt, you know, I don't think they're going to get as much as they think they're going to get for him. So I think he can make that deal. I think, you know, Seattle management has shown in the past that they overcharge quite a bit, and I don't think teams are really going to do that with Cliff Lee, especially with him being a free agent. But it's very interesting too. The Mets have made it clear too that they would very much look at Cliff Lee as a rental just for a couple months. And I believe this day and age, I said it 2 years ago actually. I think that's the way you go this day and age, like the Brewers did a few years ago with CeCe Sabathia.
Yeah.
Yeah, you point out the best pitcher, and you see that other teams aren't really jumping in there. Well, you go rent him, and then next year there's going to be another small market or team looking to dump salary is going to be in the same situation. So you can almost turn that into a yearly habit if you got the bullets to go get them.
People always rent in the summer, Kevin.
Exactly.
John Candy had a great movie, Summer Rental. Anyway, I have one for you on the Yankees before I pass it off to my partner in crime, Mr. Auriemma. And that's, you know, we had the Jabba rules. Apparently now we have the Phil Hughes rules. And I've talked about this with Jim Cott. And actually, right before you jumped aboard, we talked to Tommy Lasorda. And he said, quote, this is coming directly from Tommy Lasorda, pitch counts are the worst thing to ever happen to our game. That's precisely from him. Jim Cott told us earlier, maybe a couple of weeks back, that, you know, he believes that youngsters have to work out of situations. They have to pitch. They need to build up their arm strength. And the only way to do that is to pitch. Now, you know, everybody gets all uptight because of Kerry Wood, because of Mark Pryor. Did they ruin it for everyone else, or did they make it better for everyone else?
That's a great point, and I think you hit on it a little bit. It's kind of like with American society. You know how we go over the top with things? You know,
us?
Overprotective. Yeah, exactly. I think that that's what they've done here, and I would echo Tommy's comments, except that the radar gun, I think, is the worst thing that ever happened.
That's a fair point,
pitchers,
too.
Because then you forget about guys like that can actually pitch. And I understand what the Yankees are doing. I think they're right not to overuse a guy, and I think that's the key. Don't overuse him.
Right.
And but I'm a little concerned because Jim Cott, and I'll tell you a quick story about him. Jack McCain told me this years ago. He was his manager way back when in Missoula, and Jim, you know, Jim got in trouble in the sixth or seventh inning, and Jack came out and just said, "Hey, you got into this mess? Figure out how to get out of it." So it's not only a physical thing, it's a mental thing. These pitchers got to know how to get out of it. Like last night with John Neese, it's very interesting. You know, he came back with roughly it was about 90 minutes between pitches because of the rain delay in a big inning. And he said, if I was in the minor leagues, that never would have happened. They wouldn't have been protecting me. I didn't realize how much had changed with the heavier ball, this and that. You know, I thought I'd keep my stuff as much. So essentially, it wasn't a mistake maybe using him in that manner, but because they'd never use him in that manner, he didn't psychologically know how to address the situation. And that's the big problem with these pitchers.
And I think Kevin Hughes psychologically is better off because of last year when he came out of the bullpen and got out of those situations.
That's a great point, and that's how he grew as a pitcher. And here's the key. Phil Hughes is smart enough to do that. Some of these guys can't do it. They don't have the ability to do it. And Phil Hughes, who happens to be a big fan of The Office, you know, the comedy show, he has a sense of humor, so he can deal with things when they're not going 100%. And I think young pitchers need to have that ability. I don't think you can be overprotective. I think it hurts them. I think you have to protect them, but you don't have to be overprotective. And that would be the way I would run a team.
Kevin, it's Joe Auriemma here with the Yes Network as well. How are you?
Good, Joe. How's it going, buddy?
Good, good. I actually want to talk about a veteran pitcher right now, an A.J. Burnett. He made some comments to our own Kim Jones the other day saying that, you know, he's frustrated and that, you know, it's not, you know, a Dave Island situation where Dave Island isn't with the team, and that's not why he's pitching poorly at this point. And he also conceded, you know, this is why I'm a career 500 pitcher. What can you say about the performance of A.J. Burnett right now, and how can this get any, you know, is this rock bottom or is it going to get better?
Well, I think it's, first of all, I think those are great comments that Kim got, and I think it's right on the head. And actually, I noticed something. I was with the Yankees in Boston 2 days before he was to pitch up there, Joe. He was getting a little freaked out. Like, you know how that press, that clubhouse is. It's really crowded. There was a gentleman from the Spanish media who was kind of in the way, but he didn't know he was in the way. And A.J. was trying to get by and finally pushed him and then made comments later. And this was 2 days before he was going to start. I think pitchers need to get up for games, but I think A.J. gets himself too amped up in many different ways. He doesn't know how to relax on the mound. And as a result, I believe his, you know, and I don't want to sound like Joe pitching guru here, but as a result, I think his muscles tense up a little bit and he doesn't get the location he needs. It's that simple. He needs to really calm down. I'd recommend a yoga course for the guy, to be honest with you. And he needs to calm down because we all know he's got the greatest talent in the world. And maybe by him recognizing this, he can attack the problem, because I think that's what he has to do. And that's why I think he has these sometimes when he's lights out, and other times when he you know, he can't locate the ball. Now opposing teams are onto that. They're waiting him out. And, you know, he's really been – I don't think it's a Dave Island problem at all, although I do think Dave is great at certain things he does with A.J. and things he's done with, like, Javier Vasquez, getting him in a straight line. And that's when Javier turned it around. I think A.J.'s got to attack this himself, and he's the only one that can fix this problem. So he needs to really take a look in the mirror and say, what do I need to do to calm down out there on the mound? It's not Jorge Posada's fault. You know, it's not a pitching coach's fault. It's my fault. But why am I putting myself in this situation? And once he calms down and maybe settles down and realize, hey, you know, I'm better than this hitter. I'm better than him. I'm going to show him. Instead of worrying about all these other things, I think he'll be a much better pitcher.
You know, you make a great point. See, he's always been one to not blame it on anybody else. It's never been, oh, well, I pitch better with Jose Molina. Oh, it's not at the Dave Island situation. He's always kind of taken it upon himself. But you're right. I think he needs to take that next step and just kind of look in the mirror. And you're right. He might tense up. And a pitcher that doesn't tense up before starts is CC Sabathia. I spoke with him at the stadium, and he told me that after starts, you know, the day after, he goes for a run. It makes his arm feel a lot better. He just calms down. He does his bullpens. And right now, it's really showing. He is, you know, kind of turning it on at this point, and he's becoming the ace of the staff again.
Yeah, I'm convinced that CC is basically an NBA player. And by that I mean,
well, if you looked at his performance against Brook Lopez, you wouldn't say he's an NBA player.
That's true. I did see that. But his mentality is NBA in that he understands it's a long, long season, and you got to be ready when you're at the end, when it's most important, the second half and right on through. Plus, I think there's a physical aspect of this as well. Being the big man that he is, he can't come out of the chute, you know, in April and basically be like a Mariano Rivera, who's probably the best athlete in the major leagues and has been for the last, you know, whatever, 15, 20 years. So he knows who he is. He builds up that strength, and he gets to that point. Now, he does have some setbacks, and sometimes I think they're mental because of the physical nature. He just runs out of gas in games. I mean, but he's been electric from what I've seen. You know, he's been unstoppable first three or four innings and runs into a problem. His last outing, obviously, was terrific. And he's the kind of guy, he's a big Oakland Raiders fan as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, he wants to get it done. And I think, you know, the Yankees, by making that move of getting CC, to me was the best move Brian Cashman probably will ever make. And I think he'll be there again when they need him most. And I think that's what you're seeing now with the Rays, you know, and the Red Sox. There's some separation, a little bit of separation now. Rays are coming back to earth. But people like CC can really carry the load when you need him most. And I think he's right where he needs to be.
You know, I just have one more question for you here, Kevin. And, you know, the starting pitching really has been phenomenal. Even though Javier Vasquez struggled at the beginning, now he's pitching like a complete monster right now. And they have four solid starters. The bullpen has been a little bit shaky, but it's been an inconsistent offense that's been really a question mark for this Yankees team. However, you really can't say anything. You know, there's a lot of question marks with this team when they do have the best record in baseball.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the thing that's going to come out here is, you know, at the end, will they have people step up like Johnny Damon stepped up last year, like Matsui stepped up last year? That's still going to be the question with this team. And they certainly have the parts to do that. I was just looking at the numbers today, and the Yankees have like 100 fewer strikeouts than the Rays. The Yankees have the best approach, I think, coming into that bat. I think Kevin Long does a great job. I also think the Yankees are getting a little bit smarter about using their younger talent. You know, when Colin Curtis came on yesterday, I think he was the sixth or seventh, I'd have to double check, might be the seventh, from the 2006 draft that's played in the major leagues for the Yankees, you know, not necessarily for the Yankees, but came out of the Yankee system. So I think that's, you know, that says a lot. I thought Curtis should have made the team really coming out of spring training. I liked what he did there. He's one of these guys that gets the barrel of the bat on the ball. So I think once the Yankees figure out who their best pieces are, and we've already been through some of the veterans that they've run through, I think they'll be fine, because the bottom line is you got A-Rod, and we can't go throughout a segment without talking about A-Rod. You know, his hip is a problem. He's going to have, you know, he always finds a way how to manage his problems, no matter what they are. Plus, the guy loves to have a little drama in his life. So I think
the more
drama
on,
that shows up, the better he gets. And
now we need is another Hollywood starlet.
You know, I don't mind the starlets coming in, but to me, I'm not going to rip Lady Gaga. But to me, she's not a star. This is, you know, this isn't near Madonna. You know, this isn't someone classy coming. You know, Barbara Streisand didn't come in the clubhouse the other day. So,
no.
But this is all part of A-Rod, and this is why I love him, because I call him Mr. Entertainment right to his face.
Miles away from Yentl.
Exactly. But A-Rod loves to have this stuff going on around his life. Now that he's, you know, and even last week I wrote a column that's saying that not only is he not the best third baseman in the American League, is Longoria pounding him in the All-Star voting, he's not even the best in New York with David Wright. So I know A-Rod better than anyone. He's going to take this all on as a challenge by the end of the year. I don't know if he's going to have 30 this year. Everybody says he will. Girardi says he will. We'll see. But, you know, if he can maintain his health, when you got a guy like that in the middle of your lineup and Teixeira, everything else will fall into place offensively.
All right, Kevin, just one more thing for me. It's Chris again. We just want to thank you for your time. Just one more question, and that is, you know, I know you tweet. What's your handle again on Twitter so everyone knows?
Yeah, sure. It's NY Post and then the / whatever they call it.
Underscore.
And then my name, Kernan. And you can always go to www.nypost.com. Click on me under columnist or your Met coverage.
I just want to make sure.
There's always a link there as well to get to my Twitter. And I think Twitter is great, because basically I approach Twitter like we used to always, the sports writers used to talk in the press box. Now we just talk to the fans. And I take I take my Twittering seriously, and I'm not one of these guys that's in an ivory tower and don't respond back to people. So if you're going to – I'm not saying bring it, but I'm saying I throw my ideas out there, and I believe in my ideas. So, you know, and the Yankee fans actually, some Yankee fans were getting – one Yankee fan was getting on me the other day, and I say, hey, I got to be honest, got to tell the truth. And, again, what I write, I believe in, and I appreciate the time and certainly the plug.
No, well, we appreciate you coming on. And I brought up Twitter for one reason, and that was the reason that, you know, every 5 seconds. I mean, these people, these Yankee fans on Twitter live on not even every pitch. They live on every breath taken by every player on the damn field. And sometimes, I don't know, you know, when the game isn't even on, they're tweeting and they're saying, the Yankees need this. I want that. Listen, just relax.
Well, Yankee fans sometimes, and I think there's only, it's a new segment of Yankee fan, and I think it's not just a Yankee fan, but fans in general. You know, and actually I was talking to Armando Galarraga yesterday about this, perfect game guy.
Right.
And he says, you know, we're now getting fans, because he was talking about instant replay, we're now getting fans that think it's you're playing a game on Wii or it's a video game. People aren't playing the game in the street anymore. So these people that want everything to perfection have no clue that, you know, you got to go out. This is a game of failure, and you got to go out there and pick yourself up mentally.
Right.
And that's what this game is all about. This is not a video game. The Yankees can't have every
what
player
people,
that's a superstar.
What people don't understand is I know these guys make money, but that's their job. What these guys are is human. It doesn't matter about the contract. They could be having a bad day just like a normal individual human being who can't play baseball is having a bad day. And some days it just doesn't work out.
That's why it's so important. And that's why I think the Yankees have done a good job the last few years. It's so important to get players with character. Because character, like Joe Girardi told me when I asked him about it, said character comes to the ballpark every day. And even if you got a guy that's a little bit out of character, if you surround him by enough character guys, he'll follow along. And that's the secret to winning. It's not only getting the pitching and the talent. That's what the Yankees have done. And the Mets have kind of made that transition this year, too, because they have a much better clubhouse. Getting rid of a Carlos Delgado, I think, makes them a better team. Not that Delgado's a bad guy, but he was too into himself, too defensive. The Yankees don't have that many of the many guys. And getting back to A.J. Burnett, I'll leave you with this. I remember last year, after everything was said and done, one of the reporters, after the parade and that day of the parade, one of the reporters went up to the clubhouse and asked him a question, and AJ's response was, I don't have to talk to you for another 100, and he had the date exactly, 133 days. And to me, that shows me a guy who's worrying about too many things that he shouldn't be worrying about when God gave him the arm that can throw like he can throw. And if he can just settle down mentally, I think he'd be a much better player.
All right, Kevin, I'll leave you with this stat, and I think it's pretty ridiculous. The Mets and Yankees both had great offensive nights. The Yankees in Arizona and the Mets at home, of course, and that was against
the Tigers.
What the hell? Can't even think straight. But both teams, 1 through 4,
right,
combined 21 for 39, which is a .538 batting average, plus 14 runs scored, and they drove in 17. That's what the top of the order should be doing for both of these teams on a night in and night out basis.
That says it all right there.
I'm gonna go work.
I have the bat.
I'm gonna go work on my mind not being a sieve. And Joe and I would like to thank you, and we'd like to thank everyone out there for coming to the Off the Wall podcast. Kevin, thank you very much. We'll talk to you down the road.
Take care. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Life is so bad.